Solitaire Rose Radio, Episode 56, an interview with artist Angel Medina. I honestly can't tell you when I became convention friends with Angel Medina. We talked about how he's been coming to the convention since the Minnesota convention, that is, since the days at the Thunderbird. And I remember seeing his stuff on Dreadstar, which I talk about in the podcast. And I kind of followed his work from there because then he's doing Warlock with Jim Starlin. He's done two things with Jim Starlin. I love Jim Starlin. And I followed Angel's work, you know, even on the books that I'm not a big Kiss fan, but I read his Kiss book. Not a big Spawn fan. I read his Spawn book. Why? Because I really like Angel Medina's art. It has the classic underpinnings of that 60s and 70s Marvel style, but it also has the kind of the explosive energy of the artists who were working in the 90s, and he melded them together in a way that I don't think a lot of other artists did. There were a lot of artists who had the explosive energy, but they didn't have the solid storytelling underpinnings that Angel did. Do yourself a favor and pick up not just the Dreadstar stuff, not just that, but if you're a Kiss fan, his Kiss stuff is really good. He did 5 years on Spawn, which we talk about. He's worked all over Marvel and Image, and every year at the convention, usually at the after party, we talk old comics. Because we're both the same age. We both read the same stuff as kids. We both kind of love the same artists. I think this year at the after party, we talked Sal Buscema so much that everybody was kind of moving off to other tables and going over and drawing on their own stuff while we were talking about how much we love Sal Buscema, and it does come up in the podcast. But I have not interviewed Angel, so I thought it'd be fun to just give him a call and talk, and we talk about his career, and I'll be honest, afterward he said, I thought we were just going to talk old comics of wrestling. So we're going to have an episode soon where Angel and myself and Joe and hopefully Butch, we're just going to sit, we're going to talk old comics of wrestling. But this is more of a talking about his career, how he started drawing, and how he built a career in comics kind of from the ground up, kind of as a kid who used to draw comics all the time and then decided that's what he was going to do, and he's done it. But also, he's not working on a regular book now, and I've always been curious what happens when artists aren't working on regular books. And we talk about that, and we talk about what he's planning for the future. It's a good long interview. Angel's a lot of fun. You'll really enjoy this.
Bushwhacking is to kind of hide in the bushes and then jump out as people went by.
Ah, okay.
Kind of a surprise attack.
Oh, okay. You know, for some reason, I always thought bushwhacking always meant, you know, when you see safari movies and people are just have the big machetes and they're just cutting their way through. For some reason, I always associated that with bushwhacking. But I knew it had to be something more than that because I think Daredevil had a villain called Bushwhacker. So I figured it had to be mean something bad.
Well, I imagine even if it was Daredevil, somebody had to use it at Marvel because, come on, they used Big Wheel, Rocket Racer, the Kangaroo.
I know, you know, it's funny because I want to, just like everyone else and their mother, I want to put out my own comic, but I want to go old school where I create my own universe of heroes and villains and stuff. And whenever I come up with a character with the name, for the next, like, 30 minutes, that's all I'm doing is going online to see if anyone's used that name right now. Because just about every name has been practically used by now, you know.
Well, the good thing is, you can use the name. Because, you know, both Marvel and DC have Sandman. Both Marvel and DC have all these characters. It's just, I don't think you could trademark them.
Okay, all right. Well, I always assumed Marvel and DC were like sharing some of them, you know what I'm saying? There are certain names that you see both Marvel, like, where they both have a tarantula, I guess. and they both have a firebrand. And I always just thought, well, those were two characters that Marvel and DC thought, well, they're never going to be like a big property like Superman, so we'll just share the copyrights or something like that.
Oh, no, I can't see the lawyers for them getting together and going, well, this will be okay.
Yeah.
This will be fine.
Well, see, that's what somebody told me, because about a year ago I did another podcast interview, and the guy that I did it with, he gets into all that stuff. And I could have swore he said something along those lines and some of these, something about Marvel and DC sharing something like that. But I thought, I had the same thought you did. I just can't see, knowing the egos of Marvel and DC, they've hated each other for years, and they still hate each other. And I just couldn't see them even agreeing on that just because of the spite that exists between the two companies.
Well, and back in the 60s at least, and probably sooner, Martin Goodman was one of these guys who, well, let's face it, Martin Goodman was a dirtbag.
Yes.
But he knew when stuff would fall out of trademark, which is why Captain Marvel was rushed to the stands.
Yeah.
He found out Captain Marvel's out of trademark, and he went to Stan and said, you need to create a Captain Marvel character. It's got to be cover featured, and you've got to do it as fast as possible before anybody else does it.
And that explains why Captain Marvel's original costume looked like absolute shit. Because when I first saw that green and white costume, I said, you got to be kidding me, man. This is the worst looking piece of crap. Even for that time, that was a piece of crap looking costume.
Boy, and, you know, I love 60s Marvel. I love Stan. I love Gene Colan. But, man, that stuff's unreadable.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. I agree 100%. But it's like you said, even as a kid, I could tell that stuff was just being rushed out there. And I always thought Captain Marvel sounds like a name for like a real mainstream character. And when I saw Marvel's version of it, I go, this is a mainstream character, and this looks like a third-tier character, you know, like a third-tier villain practically, you know.
And they keep pushing it, though.
Yeah.
They keep trying to figure out that name. So, talking about comics as a kid, I've always wanted to know, because you're my age, and we like the same sort of Marvel stuff. Now, when I was a kid, I wanted to be Stan Lee. And then, you know, by the time I was 12, no, I want to be Don McGregor.
Don McGregor, there's a name that you bring up now, and every single comic book fan will look at you like, who?
Well, not all of them. With the Black Panther getting big, they're going to be reprinting a lot of his stuff.
Oh, yeah, well, now
I gravitated toward the writing end of it because I couldn't draw to save my life. Were you a kid who was always drawing stuff on everything?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I started drawing comics. Actually, I'll tell you a quick story how I started drawing comics, because I tell this a billion times. And if you heard me, you can go ahead and stop me on this. But the way I got into drawing comics was I was living my family was living in New York at that time, and I was about like 4 years old, and I hadn't learned how to read yet. But I used to watch, I think it was the Aquaman Flash Superhero Hour or something like that, but it featured, like, you know, it was Hanna-Barbera with Flash and Adam and all those characters. And so that was my first discovery of superheroes, and I thought this was the baddest ass thing I'd ever seen in the 4 years that I'd been on this planet. And so I wanted to know more about that. So my parents noticed that we, the boys, there was three of us, would be sitting around watching these superhero cartoons. My mom started buying comics for my older brother, who already knew how to read. Now, the only thing is, my older brother couldn't give a crap about comics, but my parents weren't paying attention to that. So every time they would buy him the comics, I would look through the comics myself. But I was getting frustrated that I couldn't tell what was going on. And I always remember there was one particular issue. I found out years later what issue it was, but it was an issue of World's Finest with Superman and Batman on it. And Batman was in the stockade, you know, that they used to put like the witches during the Pilgrim days. And he was yelling while he was in the stockade to Superman, which I assumed he was asking Superman to help him. And I remember I looked at this cover thinking, why isn't Superman helping Batman, who's, you know, stuck in the stockade? That frustrated me so much that I couldn't tell what was going on, that I decided, you know what, screw this. I'll just start drawing my own comic books. Now, I was too young to know that you weren't supposed to be drawing your own comic books at that age. So I was drawing them, you know, on usually on the other side of pieces of paper, you know, it has something printed on one end and the other end was blank. And so any piece of paper I could get a hold on, I was doing this. And then I was leaving the sheets of drawn pages out and about. And my mom got mad at my brother one morning, and said, you know, I'm sick and tired of you doing all these drawings and leave them scattered throughout. I want you to clean this whole thing up. And my brother said, those aren't mine. Those are angels. And she kept going, yeah, right. Those are angels. I want you to stop trying to blame it on your little brother. Pick it up. And he kept saying, no, those are angels. So finally I admitted to it. I said, Mom, those are mine. She thought I was trying to cover for my brother. So, and since we were eating breakfast at that time, we had a box of Cheerios right there, and cornflakes. And the old school cornflakes always had a rooster, like this cartoonish rooster on the box.
Yep.
And so she says, well, if these are yours, draw this rooster for me. You know, she obviously, you know, she thought, you know, I was going to call her bluff. I picked up a piece of paper, and I drew the rooster that I saw in the cereal box. And I'll never forget the reaction on my mom's face. When I saw the way my mom reacted to it, that was the first time I realized, oh, crap, I might be onto something here, you know. And so I just kept drawing comics ever since.
So when did you – now, you were in New York, and then did you move to Chicago as a kid, or did you live in New York growing up?
No, we moved in – to Chicago when I was getting ready to start the second grade. I don't know what age that is. It looked like 5 or 6 or something like that. So, yeah, I have very little memories of living in New York.
And when you got to be a teenager and you realized that all the comics were being printed in New York and New York was kind of where – well, when I was a kid, I grew up, you know, downstate Illinois outside a town of 250 people. It's like, well, everybody who works in comics lives in New York.
Yeah.
And did you kind of have that same mindset of, wow, I got to get to New York? Or did you see comics as a viable job option in your teenage years?
Both. I knew it was a viable job option because I always knew, even as a little kid, I wanted to draw comic books. But I knew it before high school because I was a pretty sharp kid. And so I absorbed these comics so much. I actually read, I don't know how to pronounce it, is it called Indicia?
Indicta.
Indicta, okay. I actually read that when I was a little kid, you know, because I would absorb every aspect of a comic. And so I actually read that, and I kept noticing that it was, I think the street was like Madison or something in New York at that time, during the 70s, you see that same address. It was like 575 Madison Avenue or something like
yep.
that. And so I'll always remember that. And so I always knew that it was in New York. But because of Marie Severin's drawings of the bullpen all the time, I always assumed that there was this big building called Marvel Comics where everyone went to work, letters, writers. And I always thought that the artist actually went, you know, like the typical 60s dad, you know, you pick up your briefcase, put on your hat, and then you go, you know, downtown to the big building called Marvel Comics, and you'd sit down with all these other artists the way Marie Severin used to draw them. And that was the life that she led as a comic book artist. So I always thought, not only did I know that that's what I wanted to do, around the 7th grade, I actually remember having a dream when I was sleeping where I was walking up to the Marvel buildings. And I remember in this dream I was wearing the 60s, you know, trench coat with the suit and tie and the briefcase and the hat, fedora hat. And as I was walking straight in front of me, I saw just this bland-looking New York tall brick building. You know, real typical just brick building. And on the top of it, you know how they always drew the Daily Planet with saying the Daily Planet in big letters? In my dream, it said Marvel Comics. And so I was dreaming that I'd grown up already and that I was going to work here at this Marvel Comics building, the way that Marie Severin always kept drawing.
I imagine the exact same thing. And then now, you know, you read all the people talking about Marvel in the 70s. And, well, there were some creators who lived in the building at times, because they couldn't find apartments or whatever, but it was a very different life. When did you kind of start looking at it, you know, not from the fantasy aspect or from what Marvel put out there, but learning about it realistically, that this is how the artists do their stuff?
Well, right after, to be honest with you, I knew I was going to get into it even during my last years of high school, but being in high school, you're too busy chasing girls and stuff like that. That I didn't. It finally hit me after I graduated from high school, and then I'll always remember right after I graduated high school, I started putting these pages together, thinking like, "Well, I got to get a job now. I have to, you know, I'm no longer in high school. All my friends still went off into the military, and my parents, they really wanted to know what I wanted to do, what I was going to do with my life." And so I just thought, well, I got to draw comics. And I had no clue how to draw get into Marvel. So I started putting these pages together, and I still own them to this day, the pages I put together. And they were mostly pinups and anatomy drawings, because I thought that's what Marvel wanted to see. So that was the first time that the idea occurred to me. Do you want me to follow it up, or do you want to ask your next question?
Oh, sure, follow it up.
Okay, so here's what happened. I mean, I'm one of those guys where the stars just aligned all correctly for me, because in the meantime, when my parents asked me what I wanted to do, I told them I wanted to draw comic books, which is the equivalent of going up to your parents and saying, you know, I want to be a rock star. And they're thinking, oh, God, I got to get this guy. How am I going to get this guy to, do something with his life? So my mom had told me, listen, do me a favor. If, at least can you take a couple of classes at Waubonsie Community College, which is the local community college near where we live. It was really, really cheap at that time. And she said, could you at least take one or two classes to make me feel like you're trying to do something with your life? And so I only did this just for my mom. I took one illustration class at this community college. When I went to this community college, there was this guy named Ron Murphy there, and Ron was heavily into comics, which I didn't know until, like I said, the stars had just lined up. That first semester, we had the very first comic book store open up in our neighborhood. And when I first walked in there, I saw Ron Murphy there, right, and I recognized him from my class. Hey, that's the guy from my class. So the next time I went to class, I said, hey, Ron, and started talking. We found out we were both into comics, started talking about it. And we wanted to show each other's art, because we both wanted to get in the business. When I showed him my art, I'll always remember the look on his face. His jaw dropped because he hadn't seen anyone put that much detail in it. And he said, listen, we got to get you to these comic book conventions. You got to show this stuff to the comic book convention. He says, the only thing is you're going to have to start all over again, because Marvel does not want to see pinups or anatomy drawings the way that you draw them. They want to see panel by panel stuff. And that was the best thing that anyone could have ever told me, because because of Ron's advice, that started getting the wheels together. He took me to my very first convention. He told me who's the guy you had to go see. He's the one who showed me where Jim Shooter was. And from there on in, I just started putting comic book pages together and showing them very specifically to Jim Shooter.
And Shooter was very well known for actually taking time with new talent.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
pointing
yeah.
out what they were doing right and what they were
yeah.
doing wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
So on those early pages, what was the advice he was giving you? Because you'd never done panel-to-panel work prior to meeting this art teacher.
Right, right. Well, I had done panel. I've been doing panel-to-panel drawings since I was a little kid. I've been drawing. As a matter of fact, I own a comic book that I did when I was in the fifth grade. Not only did I draw panel by panel, but I also drew in all the ads, and I included a Twinkies ad on it. I think it was page 18 that they had. So I even had my own little Hostess Twinkies ad on it. So I've been drawing it by myself for all these years. So when Ron told me to do the panel by panel stuff, that was easy. I've been doing this forever, So I did the panel by panel stuff. When I first showed it to Shooter, I could tell Shooter was impressed, but he told me that, he gave me a few tips here and there and said, this is what you got to do. He says, but keep showing it to me every year. Now, I should say on a side note, though, that my approach wasn't the same as everyone else's, because when I went to those portfolio reviews, I saw, there were a crap load of other artists, trying to get their stuff shown. And I seen a couple of the guys in front of me, and they just blew me away. I remember one particular guy who drew these amazing Iron Man pages, and I remember thinking, if he doesn't get hired, there's no way I'm going to get hired. And I saw that he didn't get hired. But it didn't worry me that much, because when I went to that very first portfolio review, Shooter had, I'm sure you've heard of this, that before he would look over reviews, just so he won't have to keep repeating himself, he would do a quick presentation where he would show these Kirby pages and talk about storytelling a little bit. And she used those Kirby pages as an example. This is what you want to do. You see the way Kirby does this, blah, blah, blah. After he'd finished that presentation, then he'd start looking at our stuff one at a time. Now, when I first saw that presentation, I literally could not believe how lucky I was. I was literally sitting there thinking, like, oh my God, this is a free lesson how to draw comics. I never would have dreamed that I would have had this free lesson how to draw comics. So even though I knew that if I didn't get hired, I knew I'd walk away as a better person because I just got a free art lesson. I didn't have to pay for it the way that I had to pay for Wabauzi Community College. And because of that, I really soaked in every single word that Shooter said, not only during the presentation, but also when he gave me the advice. And the reason I say all of this is because it took me 4 years to finally get my foot in the door. And that fourth and final year, when I went up to Jim Shooter about this, I remember Shooter looked up at me and he says, "You're Angel, right?" And I go, "Yeah." And he said to me, I'll never forget this, he goes, "I always remember you, Angel, when you show me your stuff, because you're the only guy that listens to the stuff that I tell him to do." And I was like, "Oh, wow." I thought everyone else was doing, I thought everyone was into it as much as I was, to be honest.
Well, one of the things that I've learned in all sorts of creative fields is, and especially with artists, because when I was in college, there would be people who would go to conventions and they would be all geamed up. "Oh, you know, I've done my best work. I can't wait to show." And they'd come back and I'd ask, you know, how you did and what they said. And "He doesn't understand what I do."
Oh, yeah.
No, you don't understand what they're looking for.
Exactly.
And successful artists, when they talk to an editor, actually listen to the editor and go, "Oh, I will give this editor what they want."
Right. And see, that's what I see. My attitude was different because it wasn't so much of give this editor what he wants. I looked at anyone who worked in comics at that time as that they were gods, they were royalty. So to me, they were giving me a gift. They were imparting me with their wisdom. And I was only get that anywhere else. And I always just thought, I'm going to listen to these guys just because they were out for my benefit. That's the way I felt better. They were out to help me. And so everything that they gave me, I absorbed it and I actually applied it to them. I remember, if you look at my portfolio that finally got me in the job, everything you need to know about drawing comics is in that portfolio because I was just, you know, absorbing every little thing that they tell you to do. You'll see an example of it in those pages that finally got me into the comic book business.
Now, as you were learning to do panel to panel, sounds like on your own as a kid, who were the artists that you looked at and said, these are the people who I want to draw like, these are the people who know what they're doing?
Right.
Because I was like you. Comic, I wasn't big into rock music. For me, John Buscema was bigger than Steven Tyler.
Oh yeah. Oh, I agree. Yeah, I agree that. I mean, to this day, I tend to bow at their feet more than I will at someone like you. See, you show me Steven Tyler, I'm like, "Look, there's Steven Tyler." But in my mind, I would say, "Well, yeah, Steven Tyler, all he did was give me good background music to listen to," whereas John Buscema actually affected my life. So
yep.
That's the way I always looked at these guys too. Yeah. The funny thing is I've always told people there's five major artists who influenced my work: John Byrne, Bernie Wrightson, Michael Gordon, George Perez, and Sal Buscema. And Sal Buscema always throws people off because they, you know, I remember once Jim McLaughlin asking, like, "Why Sal and not John?" And that's because Sal was the first artist as a little kid I imitated because John Buscema was like Michelangelo. And therefore, as a kid, I had no grasp on how to get his stuff. Was just so far beyond me as a kid. I knew I couldn't touch that stuff. I was just like, this John Buscema, even as a kid, I knew, like, I have to grow up before I'm able to draw like him. So since I was a kid, I needed more simple shapes to follow. And they didn't get any simpler or dynamic as Sal Buscema at that time. So Sal was the very first guy I really started emulating a lot. And you can still see a lot of Sal's artwork in my artwork to this day.
You and I talked Saturday night after the convention about how I think we both feel Sal Buscema does not get enough credit for what he did. And while you had Kirby and Romita and those guys, to me, the late 70s and through the 80s, Sal Buscema was the Marvel artist.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was doing 3 or 4 books a month, and they were always good.
Oh, yeah. It's funny because about like 3 years ago, you know, every year I go through these, I'm going to try to collect this series. Like, you know, there was like 3-year period where I was trying to collect as many John Buscema Thors as possible. And then after I go through that run, then I'll say, well, let me try to collect as many of Kirby's 70s Captain America's, you know, go through all those different runs, right? And there was one year where I decided that I was going to try to collect a lot of the what I call the forgotten issues, all those books that only lasted like 5 or 6 issues at a time. And one of them was Skull the Slayer, because I had heard of Skull the Slayer as a kid, but I never even saw what the character looked like. And so when I picked up a Skull the Slayer and I saw, yet even that had a couple of Sal Buscema issues, I just thought, man, is there a character, I mean, is there a series that Sal didn't at least draw one issue on, man?
And to me, his stuff captured kind of this dynamic way of storytelling that I'd rather read a Spider-Man story drawn by him than just about anybody else in the 80s, because he was always on point. He always you could follow the story easily. His pages had great flow, and his fight scenes were always very well choreographed. And you always had at least one scene where somebody's punching Spider-Man, and Spider-Man's going toward the camera.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right at ya.
Yeah, the last issue I did for Marvel, I did a scene like that where Venom is punching Spider-Man, and it's me ripping off Sal 100%. And you see Sal coming by, I mean, you see Spider-Man coming at you. And not only that, but Sal also had the famous backhand punch. Where, you know,
yes.
And that was the point. If you look at that, my last issue of Venom, I have an issue of Venom doing the Sal backhand punch and Spider-Man coming out at you. Only thing is, Spider-Man had a mask on him, so I couldn't draw the wide mouth with the spit trail. Yeah, actually, Sal, the thing I liked about Sal, and that's why even though as a kid I followed him for simplicity, but as I kept getting older, I got more attracted to his work, is that basically I learned how to draw comics from how to draw comics the Marvel way from the 70s. I studied that book like it was my Bible. And I'll always remember, like, they would do examples like in that book where they'd show when a guy is standing, you know, in an action pose. And a regular human being, when his legs are far apart, to show that, you know, he's in this fighting stand, that his legs should be about, you know, 2.5 feet apart from each other. That's the realistic way. But in comics, you draw them 3.5 feet apart from each other, add to that drama. Sal always added that extra foot, where it was 4.5 feet apart from each other. And so
yep.
Sal's poses would push it to the absolute limit. If you pushed it any farther than that, then it would start you'd start thinking, oh, well, that's just crazy. And that's what I liked about Sal, that he stretched everything about as far as you could go. There are to these days where I draw, people be flying through the air, and you'd look at the way their arms are twisted, and you think, like, man, that arm should be, it probably came out of its socket the way Angel drew it. But I think, well, that's the way Sal would draw it, to show, you know, emphasize impact. You know, he wasn't going for realism. And that's what I like about Sal. No, I don't think there's not a single artist out there, and this includes Kirby, that did great fighting, that showed as much impact during the fighting scene as Sal did. Because Kirby could still do that, but he would use other mechanics where Sal would just take the body and contort it to its absolute maximum.
And his run on Hulk, same thing.
Yeah.
You would always look forward to the fight sequence, almost to the point where you didn't care about the rest of the story. It's like, okay, there's Bruce Banner and the drama, and when's he going to beat the shit out of the UFOs?
That was it. That was it for me, 100%. You know, it's funny because as a little kid, when I was in the 6th grade, I remember reading those Sal Buscema. Sal was being inked by Joe Staton at that time. And I looked forward to those issues because of that. And yet when I was in high school, and this is the point where Sal was drawing and inking him, I was looking forward to those comics just as much as when I was a little kid, and just for those action scenes. The first issue I bought when I finally started making my own money was when Captain Marvel was an issue of Hulk, and I remember the famous backhand where Hulk did the backhand, and it was a full splash page, and he backhanding Captain Marvel. And I was in high school at that time, and just looking at that page and going like, wow, this is why I read comics, for that panel right there.
Yep. Now, my first experience with your artwork was when you came onto Dreadstar.
Yeah.
But you worked in comics before, so what was kind of where you broke in? Where did you first first get that ink on a page?
Well, the actual work, I remember when I was telling you I was drawing my stuff to Jim Shooter, I actually started drawing with a really small black and white outfit called Megaton Comics. And that was with Eric Larson and Rob Liefeld. And I can't remember, there's another artist, I can't remember his name, Hall Baker. That's Clark Hall Baker.
We had him at the convention a few years ago.
Yeah. It was those three guys were doing a book at that time. And then I remember this was one of the years where I showed my stuff to Marvel and DC and neither one of them had accepted me yet. And so I remember thinking to myself, like, well, you know what? I need an ego boost. And whenever I showed my artwork to, like, the guys who were doing black and white comics, because they were all the rage back then, the independents doing the small time, the independent guys were doing like black and white. And I said, let me show it to the black and white guys just to get my ego boost. Cause usually they'll say, they look at my arm and go, oh my God, this is amazing, blah, blah, blah. So I went to the first black and white booth that I saw. It was Eric Larson. I didn't know Eric Larson and I didn't know about his famous reputation for tearing people a new ass when he criticizes their artwork. So I went up to him looking for an ego boost, and instead he tore me a new one. And I remember to the point where I was literally trying to tear the pages out of his hand in a polite way, like, yeah, thank you. Like, okay, I get it, I suck. And it surprised me because after I finally pulled the pages from him, I couldn't wait to get away from his table. The publisher was standing behind Eric. And as I walked a few feet away, he made Eric call me back and said, yeah, do you want to do some work for us? And I remember just standing there going, dude, you just tore my stuff to shreds and now you're asking me? And then the publisher pulled me aside later on. He goes, yeah, that's just the way he is. He likes to give people more than they expect. But he really liked my stuff. So I actually started getting it published then. But even then at that time, I was so fixed on working for Marvel or DC that I didn't really look at that stuff as all that with as much glamour. You know, I know I was getting published and stuff, but I didn't put as much seriousness into it as I probably should have, especially as much as Eric and Rob were putting into it at that time.
Now, your mom had wanted you to, you know, to be, like all moms do, you put aside this silliness and get a career. How did you kind of keep her at bay while you're working your craft and showing the stuff to Jim Shooter every year?
Well, I mean, I was a responsible young adult. I went ahead and I worked at Sears, worked at retail. A couple times I took a job at like these factories that were always laying people off. And my mom thought, well, at least he's getting a regular paid job. She didn't realize that I knew that since they were laying people off, I would get these jobs just so I could make a huge sum of money in a short amount of time, and then they would lay me off. And so let's put it this way. She accepted the fact that she saw I was trying, you know.
Okay.
She did, though, when I did transfer from a community college to a big university, she did try to convince me to switch over from illustration to computers. And which I didn't do, but then it was during my last couple of years at NIU where I finally broke in with First Publishing. And when she started seeing that I was getting checks from doing the artwork, that's when she finally just started backing off because she said, well, it's not like he's going around, you know, partying and everything. He's going, you know, he's staying up late in his room drawing and they're sending him checks. So, you know, I think in her head it was always just like, well, I guess if he can do something with it, he can do something with it. I don't think she ever really fully accepted the fact that it's a job. I don't think she understands it to this day, but she just knows now that I'm, you know, paying my bills with it and, you know, putting a roof over my head and all that other stuff.
I think a lot of parents don't understand when you have a job that's not the conventional sort of job that they grew up with.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't go to a workplace.
Yeah.
Working at home for a lot of parents is, when are you going to stop messing around and grow up?
Oh, yeah. My parents always, you know, they have memories of me when I was a little kid. And that's what I did for my leisure time. I would sit down behind, you know, with the TV on watching cartoons, drawing. And that when I was in college and I was still... And not only did I have the TV still on cartoons, I was still drawing the same stuff. It's almost like watching your kid play, you know, playing in the backyard and see him play in the backyard, but now someone's giving him a check for it, you know. My dad had a harder time accepting this because my dad was from that old school where you didn't just get up and go to work. You went to work to a job that you hated. You came back with your hands dirty. That was his whole mindset. He's always been like that, and he's still like that, you know. He's retired right now, and as I talk to you right now, I'm looking outside my porch window, and I'm looking to the window that goes inside our basement. He's building an extra room right now. He's actually, because that's his life. His life is a man gets up and dirties his hands, and that's how a man spends his life is, you know, dirtying his hands up and then comes home, gets fed, and goes to sleep and stuff. So I don't think he's ever accepted it. But he did tell me one day, this was years ago, I remember one time he told me, he goes, yeah, you know, Angel, I got a lot of respect for what you do because I couldn't do what you do where you just sit down all day long,
yeah,
you know, and just sit, because he says he doesn't have that, the attention span to do that. He'd start feeling a little too antsy, you know. And that is a discipline to be able to sit down in the chair, you know, for like 7-8 hours straight.
Well, I always say, I know I'm finally getting my writing to where it's getting out there, but, you know, you tell people that you write or you draw or you do stuff like that, and they go, oh, yeah, you know, I'd like to blah, 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 but they don't have the discipline to sit their ass in the chair and do it.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true. There was a point where one of my brothers, he's 1 year younger than me, about like 10 years ago, he went through the whole thing where, you know, his company went under. He was, you know, without a job for a while there, and he was struggling to get by. And when we were little kids, he used to actually draw, not as much as I do, but he also liked to ink a lot. And he asked me, he goes, Angel, you think I could get a job maybe inking? I go, yeah, start putting a few samples together, and I'll take you to the cons with me, and we'll show you around. And, you know, this was several months before the convention, and when convention showed up, I asked him about it. He finally admitted, he goes, Angel, I just don't have the discipline to sit down. And he goes, I tried doing that, but, you know, there's a certain point where if you haven't been doing it for a while, it really gets hard for people to just be able to, you know, sit down because they start getting antsy. They feel like they got to have a sense of movement, you know.
Yep. And also it's like, well, this should be easy. Now you got to do it for a long, long time.
Yeah, yeah. It isn't easy. Someone just put on Facebook a meme that says all the people who are saying how hard it is, except for art people who are not in the art tradition. They, in their mind,
right,
they think you're sitting down, you know, you're sitting down and you're sketching. That's something people do for their leisure time, you know. And I'm just like, yeah, but it's leisurely time because you're not doing it for long periods of time.
Now, I remember you coming on to Dark. Now I'm going to get the name wrong. Dreadstar. Did you come in while Starlin was still on it, or was Peter David writing it?
I came on Starlin's last issue. And,
okay.
Then Peter David was coming on. I came in to do that final year when I showed my stuff to Shooter, and he didn't accept it. First Publishing accepted my work that year. And when they saw the, when Rick Oliver was the editor at that time, when he saw the pages, he says, okay, I got to get this guy something. And the first thing that he had in front of him was that they needed someone to fill in an issue of Dreadstar. And he looked at me and he just said, yeah, we'd like to try you out on this Dreadstar book. And I did it. And then after I did that one fill-in issue, Jim Starlin saw those pages and he said, can we get this guy on a regular office? And so, because they knew they had Peter David all lined up, but they hadn't lined up an artist yet. And then when Starlin saw my stuff, he said, yeah, see if we can get this guy.
So, being around my age, being as crazy about comics as I was, when you get a Jim Starlin plot or script, however he did it, was that a little intimidating? Or was it more like, you know, you just scored the touchdown in the Super Bowl?
Well, the intimidating part wasn't so much the script. The intimidating part was getting a call from Jim Starlin. That was more intimidating because once you talk to the guy and he asks you, you know, how he likes to draw, and he always told me, like, I'm going to send you a script, but feel free to play around with it or whatever. So for me, the intimidating part was when Jim Starlin first, I got a phone call from Jim Starlin, which, by the way, I did not believe. When I first picked up the phone, and this was not too long after a convention, and I had already talked to Jim Shooter, and so when I got that call, and it says Angel Medina, I go, yeah, this is Jim Starlin. In my head, I went, yeah, right. I thought it was my friend Ron, the guy I told you who introduced me to the cast. He was a practical joker. So I thought he was trying to pass himself off as Jim Starlin. So in my head, I go, oh, hey, Jim, how's it going? Now, the funny thing is I've gotten to know Jim over the years, but whenever I bring this up to Jim, I said, yeah, the very first phone call that you ever gave me, I was being a real smartass because I thought you were my friend Ron. Now, Jim does not remember the smartass part about it, but I do remember being a real smartass. And then later on, found out I felt like, oh, crap, it really was Jim Starlin. First bonus call, so yeah. But the touchdown feeling did come when I first got that script. However, Jim hadn't gotten to that point where he just said, you know, play around with it as much as you want. So there was no intimidation there. It was just a fact, like, oh, crap, you know, I'm actually getting to write, you know, for Jim Starlin. I mean, Jim Starlin was one of my gods, to be honest with you, as a kid. The fact that I was getting to draw, you know, because I read Dreadstar when it was with Epic, that Morpheus Odyssey or whatever.
Yep.
And so to me, that was just like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm, you know, getting to do this.
And then you moved to Marvel a few years after that.
Right.
Now, was that while Shooter was still at Marvel, or was Shooter gone by the time you were able to move to Marvel?
No, Shooter was gone because what had happened was that fourth year when I told you I showed that stuff to Shooter and Shooter said that he remembered me, I had thought this would be the year that they hire me, you know? And the truth is, and this isn't my ego talking, I was hireable for Marvel at that time, which is why when First Publishing picked me up, Rick Oliver was shocked that Marvel hadn't picked me up. Now, the thing I'll always remember is when I showed Shooter that stuff, he was not in a good mood, and his critique of my artwork wasn't very good. I just remember him saying, like, yeah, you know, your stuff is looking good, but you're just not ready for Marvel, and I could sense something was wrong there. So after he left, Romita Sr. was sitting behind him, and I guess he noticed how much Shooter's work crushed me. That Romita stepped right up, and he says, "Don't listen to what he says. You know, he's been having a bad day, blah blah blah, or whatever." And so he gave me a better critique, you know. But he couldn't hire me because that was Shooter's job. Shooter got canned from Marvel 4 months after that. So looking back, I think that Shooter was going through all that crap at that time. That's why he was in the state that he was in. I think that if all that stuff were eventually led to him getting fired wasn't happening, he probably would have hired me at that year. But since he had all that other stuff, I think when he was at that con, he was just on autopilot. So yeah, by the time I got into Marvel, he was definitely gone.
And what book brought you into Marvel?
I did a fill-in for, I did an annual, actually, for Hulk, and I got that through Peter David, because Peter David had been writing Dreadstar. And when they said that they needed an artist for that Hulk book, Peter David said, well, I got this guy on Dreadstar, he might be a good guy for that. So I did that Hulk annual, but I was still working with First Publishing. And after Marvel got that Hulk annual, they were trying to get me to do some try to see if they can sway me away from First Publishing, so they started offering me different projects. What finally solidified it was Jim Starlin took me out to dinner at the San Diego show to see if he could get me to. He hadn't made the announcement yet, but he was going to bring back Warlock, which is one of my favorite characters of all time. And when he first told me that at dinner, I got excited just by the fact that he was bringing Warlock back. I did not expect him to say, we want you to draw it. So when he told me, we want you to draw it, I was trying to be real cool about it. But I remember after the dinner, I ran to my hotel room and I started calling all my friends up. And the first guy I called was Ron, the guy who first introduced me to the convention, saying, Ron, you're never going to believe this, man. They just offered me Warlock. And he's like, you mean Adam Warlock? Yeah, that Adam Warlock. He goes, but he's dead. He goes, no, Ron, they're bringing him back, and I'm the guy who's going to. And I was just like, probably one of the greatest moments of my life.
And that book, actually, I remember it doing very, very well. I was working comics retail at the time, and it spun out of Marvel's first really big, successful miniseries that didn't have the word secret or war in it.
Right, 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 yeah.
So, and that was also when comics were selling through the roof. So were you one of those people who got the checks that made your eyes pop?
Oh, yeah, I was. Oh, my God, you know. funny, but that when I did that Hulk annual, which I did before that, when the royalty check for that thing came out, it was so much money that I remember calling up the editor and saying, like, because I thought it was a mistake. I said, there's no way they're selling me this much money. And so when I called up the editor, his name was Craig Anderson. I remember, hey, Craig, I just got the watch check for the Hulk. And before I could say another word, he said, I knew you'd like that. I was just cheating. This is mine. This is all mine. Quick story, though, about that. That wasn't a very happy story, though, because since I've been working in comics up to that point, not a single human being ever told me about me paying my own taxes to the government.
Oh,
or
no.
Or more importantly, what you have to call these prepayment installments that all self-employed people have to pay. And I did not know about that. Since I had not paid that, the government was putting late fees and penalty fees on what I owed them at that time. So that check I got from the Hulk, that came in on a Thursday. That Friday when I went to the bank to deposit that money, the teller told me she couldn't get into my account because the government had put a lien on it, which I had no clue what the heck any of that stuff meant. And she said, you have to call the IRS. So when I called up the IRS, this is before all that auto voice speak or whatever. You could actually talk to a person when you called the IRS. She was the one who explained to me, like, oh, no, you were supposed to do this, you know, years ago when you first started working for First Publish, and now you had all these penalties. And I'll always remember telling her, well, nobody told me. How was I supposed to know? And I'll always remember her words responding, sir, the IRS is not responsible for blah, blah, blah. In other words, she was telling me, you're screwed. You have to pay this amount. So that entire check that I got, that huge lump of money, I lost it within that weekend because it all went to the government.
Oh.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So, no, but luckily Warlock came along and then, you know, the check started coming in again.
Now, one of the things I want to talk to you about, and we'll get into it a little more later, is the actual business of being a comic artist. Because while you may be under contract or you have a series or whatever, you're still very much an independent contractor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's the hardest part of doing this whole business. You know, people say, oh, you're just so lucky you get to do this and that and whatever. And I always try to tell you, I go, yeah, you know, but they, you know, everything, you got to pay for something some way. And one of the things is your taxes. It takes me literally 2 months to prepare my taxes for me. I prepare, you got to prepare as much of it yourself as possible because otherwise the accountants will start charging you by the hour. So I literally almost do my taxes on my free time, and it takes me about 2 months to, you know, you keep every single receipt that comes into your life, and, you know, you try to put it in a specific order and make sure this can get right off. And that's one of the downsides of it is that doing your taxes as a self-employed freelancer, that gets really intimidating.
I know people who do a lot of that, or they do a lot of freelance work, and they literally have a notebook that they write everything down in.
I
spent this much money on gas to go to this show.
Yeah.
I had a signing at this shop. I bought this meal. I did this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's funny you say it because I just came home 5 minutes before you called in my car, in my little handle pocket on the side of my door. I do have a little notebook there where I keep track of all the miles, like whenever I go to make FedEx, you know, actually I got a con coming up this weekend, and last Friday I had to take some clothes to the dry cleaner that I'm going to wear for the convention, and I actually had to write the miles that it took to get from my house to the dry cleaners, because those are, you know, that's for convention purposes. That's the one thing I learned. You have to keep track of every penny that comes into your life, and that's a pretty daunting task if you ever try doing something like that.
So you're at Marvel. Were you just doing the one book, or did they try to get you to do more than one?
No, actually, let me go back a little bit. When I was doing for First Publishing, and they saw my Hulk stuff, Fabian, now you know who I'm talking about. I think his last name is called Nicesia. Is that how it's spelled?
Nicesia.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I can never pronounce that guy's name. He wanted me to work for him. That time, he was trying to get all these new guys, which is how he got connected with, like, Rob and all those other guys. So he was trying to get me in to become part of his little clique there. And so he wanted me to come in. Only thing is I told him that I had already promised first that I would go up to issue 50 of Dread Star, and so I wasn't going to break that promise. So he says, well, listen, we really want you here at Marvel, so what we would like for you to do is could we at least give you a story on, there was a book called, was it Marvel Age? That would have had, like, it was a comic full of, like, stories that are only, like, 5 or 6 pages long. You know what
Marvel Comics Presents.
Oh, wait, was it Marvel Comics Presents? Yeah.
Yep,
so,
there was a bi-weekly book, and each, they
right.
had 7 and 8 page stories.
Right. So they were going to have an ongoing storyline based on the Soviet super soldiers. And so I started, originally I was giving to Rob Liefeld, but then he got the Hawk and Dove series. So then Fabian asked me to do it. And so I had started doing the Soviet super soldiers. He said, listen, this way you can still do Dread Star, but then we got you doing some Marvel work. He just wanted me under the Marvel banner. So he says, listen, what we'll do is you can, since we only need like 5 pages, take your time on it. You know, he says, we won't start publishing till we stack up a bunch of pages. So he says, if you can only do 1 page a month, do 1 page a month. And then that way, just keep sending us, you know, pages. And so that's what I kept doing. I was drawing Dreadstar regularly, but every month I get in 1 or 2 pages of Soviet super soldiers drawn, and I would send that off to Marvel. So that's how I didn't start like directly onto Marvel. I sort of folded my way in smoothly. And then after a while, when, like I said, the stars were all lined up for me in my career, that by the time Dreadstar went away, that's when First Publishing started to really crumble. And at that same time, that was the time where Jim Starlin was starting to look for a new artist to do Warlock, and all that stuff happened all at once.
Now, you've been coming to the Minnesota convention forever, but I honestly don't remember when you first started coming.
I don't remember either, to be honest with you. I think, I know it was during the Thunderbird days. And
yep.
So I want to say it was maybe like late 1990s, something, somewhere around there. I remember it was, it's longer than I want to admit. I think that's one of the reasons why I don't keep track of it. Because this is the only convention that I've been going to that consistently more than any other con. All the other cons I go, I try to keep it, a decent rotation of it. But Spring Con is one con that I've been going to religiously. But that's just because that's where I didn't just meet you. I met all those other guys. This is the one convention where I meet just people more around my type of fandom, where we all grew up reading the same comics at the same time. We're more strictly comics as opposed to, people who dabble in comics and dabble in this or whatever. In other words, this is the only place where we can have the kind of conversations, not only that you and I have, but the way the kinds of me and you and that whole group had the last time I was there.
Yeah. And the thing I remember of you coming to the convention, our pal Butch, he doesn't ever have a lot of money, but he was always trying to scrape together money to get your pages. He loved your stuff because it was that old school style of storytelling. While you were at Marvel and the Image Boys were taking off and even guys like Herb Trimpe were trying to draw like that, was there ever any pressure for you to change your style? Or did they just say, we like what you do, do what you do?
No, I think they assumed that I was one of the Image Boys because I hung around with them. So they just assumed that my style was, my style. Let's put it this way. There was the Eric Larson style of artwork. There was the Rob Liefeld style of artwork. There's the Todd McFarlane style of artwork. My style of artwork was really basically me ripping off all the 70s guys. But they thought of it, oh, see, that's his style of artwork, That's his image, that's his contributions to the whole image. So I never really had any problems with that. The only other time I had any problems as far as with Marvel was right before I quit, when they did start changing my artwork. And that, there was no real rhyme or reason to that. I think most editors were doing stuff like that more to show the guys on top that they were doing something aggressive with their editorial skills, and so they started changing my artwork. But they had nothing to do with, I think, changing, that they were trying to change my style in a certain way. That was more for the editor's sake than anything. That's the only time I ever had any problems with anyone, wanting to change my artwork. I didn't have to deal with any of that stuff, nor was I going to deal with it, because I do remember when Marvel started changing my artwork, my first thought was like, well, fuck this, I don't want to do this. I'll just, you know, jump over to, like, since I knew the image guy, I remember I just called Todd up, and I say, Todd, man, these guys are really starting to screw with my artwork. And Todd knew that was going to happen. And so he just said, yeah, well, just come on over with us and, you know, let them get over it. Because he knew that this was, this is back when Marvel was going through their really rough periods right after the 90s and stuff. So he said, yeah, just come over with us, and then when things settle down, we'll see what you can do with them. But in the meantime, if you want to just come over, draw with me, you know, that's what we did. So.
Yeah, you actually had a pretty long run on Spawn.
Yes, yeah, much longer than anybody anticipated, including Todd or myself, you know. I had a tendency to do books regularly on a two-year basis. I do books for about 2 years. My Warlock run was about 2 years. My Hulk run was about 2 years. So I tend to stay on books for about, like, 2 years. And so when Todd asked me to do Spawn, I think we both anticipated me being on there for 2 years. The problem that happened was I ended up being on there for 5 years because I sort of got spoiled by Todd, because Todd's way of working was usually we'll fax. At that time, they were faxing stories. He goes, I'll fax you 2 issues worth of stories. Very loose plot. I mean, very, very loose plot. And then I got to play around with these, you know, 2 issues. And then I would send it in. And then they would, you know, fax me the next 2. So I rarely talked to the publishing guys, you know, during the year. Every once in a while, I would talk to Todd, and it was rarely ever about work. We would just talk about the BS. But we rarely ever talked about work. When you're working like that, when you got nobody bothering you, you just send you, you know, 2 plots every 2 months, and then you tend to get, you know, kind of comfortable working that way. You know, whereas with Marvel, when you work with Marvel, you've got editors looking over your shoulders all the time. And so when I started working with Todd, it was almost like a vacation for me that instead of 2 years, it lasting 5 years because I just got so spoiled working with them, you know.
And again, did he give a lot of, this is how I want the book to look, or was it more just draw the way you want to draw?
Oh, draw the way you want to draw. When Todd, you know, here's the thing is that I'm not the sharpest guy in the world, but I'm also, you know, not dumb either. So when I was going to leave Marvel, the first guy I went to was Todd, because you look at the similarities in between Todd's style, Greg Capullo's style, and my style, we were all influenced by the same guys. So when I left Marvel, I thought, well, the only guys who put out artwork the way that I like to draw was Todd McFarlane at that time. So he was the first guy that I went to because I just thought, well, I got the type of artwork he's looking for. So when he hired me, it was no real big surprise. So that by the time I got on Spawn, you know, I was already doing the Todd style of house of artwork, not because I was trying to do that. That's just the way I like to draw. So that when I did get on Spawn, Todd told me, he gave me only 2 things that he wanted me to do on Spawn. He says, one, I want you to bulk them up a little bit, because he saw my first renditions of Spawn and I wasn't making them as heavy as he wanted. He says, just bulk them up a little bit. And two, he said, Spawn is not the primary character of this book. Shadows are. And that was his way of saying, draw as much black as you can possibly can on this book. And other than that, he just said, from here on in, just draw it exactly the way that you want it to. And that's what he did. He never told me ever anything on Spawn to try to change, not in my storytelling, not in the approach. I never, ever got anything from Todd ever. As a matter of fact, to be honest with you, before I did Spawn, I did, for 2 years, I did the Kiss book for him. He was doing a Kiss Cycles with this book. And that was the first regular series I did for Todd. And I remember, I think 4 months into that series, I was talking with Todd on the phone, and we were just BSing, and at one point in the conversation, I stopped. I go, hey, listen, Todd, by the way, getting to it, talking about work, it's been 4 months I've been doing the Kiss book. You haven't said anything about it. Is there anything you want me to change it? And before I could even finish that sentence, he stopped, and he goes, Angel, listen, I'm afraid that if I say anything to you, you'll stop doing what you're doing. He goes, I don't want to slow you down. I want to keep you on your deadlines. And I know the way to keep you on your deadlines is just to let you draw the book the way you're drawing it. So he says, I don't want to say anything at all, because then I'm afraid, you know, it'll start hurting the schedule on the book. So I think that Todd knew that if he just left me alone, the pages will come out on time. That's another reason why he liked me on Spawn, why he didn't stop me after the 2-year, we hit the 2-year mark, is because he liked the fact that the book was coming out more regularly because of the way I was turning in the pencils. Spawn was never on time, and the main reason had to do more with Todd than it ever really had to do with the pencilers, because pencilers, when you give them that much freedom, they're just cranking the stuff out, and that's all I was doing with Todd, and he didn't want to disturb the scheduling on those books.
Now, we think of comic book fans as kind of fanatic, but I'm not a huge KISS fan, but I know some, and they make comic book fans look, you know, laid back.
Oh, yeah. I did a few. When I was doing that book, I had to do a couple of KISS conventions. Oh, my God. The KISS fans scare me, man. And yeah, this is a guy who's been going to comic book conventions for a long time. Oh, my God, those guys, to them, their God and savior is Gene Simmons, 100%.
Did they ever give you any crap over your art, or were they more just coming down and worshiping the fact that the book actually came out?
Oh, no, the fans loved it. But that's because, excuse me, when Todd first gave me first of all, when I knew I was going to work for Todd, I knew I was going to do Spawn stuff. But then he threw a curveball on me. It was like about 2 weeks after we worked out the deal, he calls me up and he says, Angel, I want to do a KISS book with you from, you know, the band KISS. Now, a year before that, one of the worst comic books that KISS ever did came out from Marvel. This is when Marvel was crumbling. It was called History, one of the biggest pieces of crap you've ever seen in your life. So when Todd offered me that, I thought he was literally joking. And I said, there's no way in hell I want to do a KISS book, you know. And so, but he kept trying to, you know, he said, wait, before, and he kept talking into it or whatever. And, you know, as we kept talking about it, I finally, you know, I let him do his little spiel, but I finally ended it. I go, listen, Todd, I don't want to do a comic book about superheroes and guitars. That's just the bottom line. I'm not going to, he kept saying, Angel, it's not going to be that. He goes, Angel, do you think anyone can make a KISS book work? And I said, of course, you can make anything work if you do it a certain way. I said, you can make a KISS book work, but KISS has to be done a very specific way for me. And I thought, because I was a KISS fan when I was in high school, in junior high. And I said, you know what? If we can make this a serious comic book, we can make it work. If you make it work, KISS always, people wanted to see the KISS. KISS fans did not want KISS, you know, with the Phantom of the Amusement Park. They didn't really want that. That's the type of people who didn't understand this stuff. I said, if we can make it like more of a horror book. And I remember telling Todd it was hard for me to describe. So Todd finally said, listen, tell you what. Do 4 promo pieces of what you think would make a kick-ass KISS book. And then send it over to me. And so I did. I did these very serious, where we got rid of completely the KISS as human beings. We turned them into deities. That the only connection with KISS was really were the deities who had the KISS makeup on, and that was their symbol. And when I showed that to Todd, I remember saying, they're not going to go for it, but this is what I'm thinking. And when I showed that to Todd, he said, this is exactly what we want. And then they showed them to Gene Simmons, and Gene Simmons said, this is exactly what we want. And then when they came back to me, he said, tell you what, we'd like for you to do the KISS where you get free reign on them, do whatever you want on them, just do them like this. And that's what we did. And then suddenly, to be honest with you, another thing is Todd told me, he goes, listen, do this for me, Angel, we're only going to do it for 4 months. He says, after 4 months, we're going to have to cancel the series because it's not going to go longer than 4 months. Then the first issue came out, and it was the best-selling book of that month. And I said, oh, crap, now I'm stuck with this. But then we did get, when I saw the fan response, they were all like, thank you, this is what we wanted for years, not that campy stuff. Because in their minds, they said the KISS spirit means as heavy as you can go, and that's what we did. I remember when I drew that book, I was thinking, like, this, we're just going to make this as, you know, as heavy, as dark, with as many spikes, and make the KISS, they were literally gods, and that's what we treated the book. They weren't human beings at all, and the fact that we rarely showed the KISS members until when they were needed, that I think just enhanced the feel of the book, and made, I think that book turned out to be much more respectable than what anyone ever expected to come out of a KISS book. I mean, we got plenty of fans who were not KISS fans who told me they bought the book just because they said, man, this was a kick-ass idea.
And that was during a time when comics weren't doing real well, and that book lasted, like you said, 2 years.
Oh, yeah.
And So you kind of went through the boom and bust period and continued to work that entire time. Were you concerned when comics went through the 94 to 97 period when everything fell apart, or were you just too busy making sure the pages got done on time?
I was thinking more, you know, funny thing is I was just thinking more about what I wanted to do. My whole point was, during this whole upheaval, everyone was concerned more about finances and stuff. I wasn't. I was concerned more about just being able to draw comics the way that I wanted to draw them, because my attitude ever since I got into this business was, I've always loved drawing comics as a kid, and if I'm going to take this up as a job, I'm going to only accept the assignments that I want to do. I didn't want to have to, you know, I had been off. There's certain series I did turn down just because I thought, that doesn't sound like fun to me. If I'm going to draw comics, it's got to be fun. Because if it's not going to be fun, then I should, then I'll just go get a regular job and have better health insurance and better health security and just draw comics for, you know, as a hobby. So the whole time I've been in this industry, and that's the way I am today, I think, like, if I'm going to draw comics, it has to be 100% fun. So when all that crazy, when the, all that disturbing stuff was going, I never paid attention to, like, what was going on with Marvel or DC, because I always, in my head, I thought, well, this upheaval, I can see why it's going on, because I was one of those guys, and when I started seeing all the embossed covers and all the tricks that they were trying to do to sell comics, I hated those comics, you know. I thought, like, well, I grew up when the way you sold comics was by putting out good comics, and these people aren't putting out good comics. So when all that stuff started crumbling, I go, well, of course, that's because you're not putting out good comics. I just thought, well, this is the way the universe reacts to stuff like this, and it'll shock people back into, well, now we got, I guess the only choice we have is we got to do good comics. So that's why I actually went to Todd, is because, you know, I wasn't that big of a fan of Spawn, but I knew what Todd's feeling was. Todd was drawing comics in the way that he wanted to draw comics. And so when I got to draw with him, he was letting me draw comics the way. So that's the only way. That was my only thought, was just keep myself on track and let everything else evolve to the way it, you know, the universe is going to evolve the way it's going to evolve, whether you, you know, whether you agree with it or not, so you might as well just have a good time doing it. You know, does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think a lot of people who come at sort of a career with that attitude of, you know, if I'm not having fun, why do it?
Yeah.
Those are the people who put out the best work.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, you had guys like John Buscema who, well, this is a job, and I guess it's better than advertising, but he's, you know, one in a million. How many other guys who came into comics, and then when, oh, look, it's a little harder than I thought, or it's a business, it shows on the page.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was always like, you know, every series that came my way, I always, oh, I want to do this, you know. Like I said, I have been offered issues, stories, and that I didn't want to do, you know. I got Joe Quesada once offered me Moon Knight, and I remember thinking to myself, oh, God, I don't want to draw Moon Knight, you know. But I didn't want to turn the guy down. So, well, let me take a look at your script. And he showed me the script. I remember thinking, oh, God, this is like the most boringest thing. So I didn't accept it, which was just good, you know, because then I would have hated drawing that book, you know. That's always been my attitude, you know. As a matter of fact, I actually quit the very last project I ever did for Marvel. I ended up quitting halfway through it, thinking, okay, I'm done with it. And Marvel actually had to convince me to, hey, well, you know, we want you to stay on it. And they actually changed the book so that I would stay on it, when in my head I thought, well, like, well, once they quit, I thought they were going to be relieved that I quit. And instead, they were doing everything in their power to keep me on. And that's just because they knew that if they kept me happy, the one thing that you, when you love doing what you do, you don't think about deadlines, you know. I never really had that much problem with deadlines for the majority of my career, but that's because in my head I never thought of, like, oh, it's due this date. It was like, okay, I'm getting to draw a Warlock. Oh, cool. Here, let me draw the Warlock pages, and then you send them in. And when you turn in works on time, that's a big selling point. Marvel loves that. And so I think one of the reasons they didn't want to lose me is because they said, well, we can really count on this guy. And so that's what I always had to manage there. So they looked at it that way, where I always told them, listen, you got to let me do what I want to do, or else you're not going to get the, you know, stuff in on time. And they were like that with me. I mean, my second tenure at Marvel, that's when they had a certain way, a Marvel way, and that didn't include me. They said, listen, we're going to send you tight, full scripts, but that's more because that's where we send it to other guys. Don't let this out that much, but you don't have to follow the scripts, which I did.
And you told me a story about a book you were working on with a character that's basically built for visuals, and it was Talking Heads. It was 22 pages of Talking Heads.
Yeah. That was one of the last... I got assigned to do an Avengers book with Bendis writing it, which is, as soon as you mention Bendis, then that's where all the Talking Heads come in. And there was one particular page where it was just like 16 panels of Talking Heads with a Tony Stark talking. And I thought, and the thing is that Bendis wanted the same headshot drawn in every single panel, except with little minor changes to their facial expression. So it wasn't in a point where I can just draw one panel and then stack them, you know, 15 times. I had to keep drawing that same head over and over again, just with different expressions. And that's what Bendis does. I mean, you still see a lot of Bendis stuff, artists do follow that.
Yeah.
I remember drawing the first Stark head, and then when I had to draw the second Stark head, I thought he was supposed to be angry, and he just wanted the Stark head showing him just gritting his teeth. So rather than drawing that, I drew this really long horizontal panel where you see a sharp close-up of Tony Stark's mouth with the gritted teeth instead of drawing the whole head. And when Bendis saw that, he sort of called the editor up and said, no, I kind of want him to stick to the heads. And then I came back, well, that's kind of boring. And so I just told the editor, tell you what, why don't you just get me off this book before, let's nip this in the bud now. And so I only drew 8 pages of that Avengers story before I finally got off it.
And I think there was sort of almost a sea change in storytelling.
Yeah.
As you talked about how you used to get plots, now you're getting scripts.
Yeah.
And while Bendis was an artist, he really came at even his art as more cinematic than comics.
Oh, yeah. And that gets pretty boring as an artist visually. I can see Bendis' side of it, but Bendis is more a writer than an artist, and so he's really going for the writer side of it. This is the way, you know, he's, like you said, he's thinking more of a cinematic view. And I'll be honest with you, that's another reason why I never liked the comic book adaptations of movies, because it always seemed much more boring to me. You know,
yeah.
I remember when the Batman movie came out and they did the comic book adaptation. I got it because of Jerry Ordway's art, but I remember even looking through the whole thing thinking, there's just something about it that's just very boring about it to me. You don't get to be as dynamic as you want, which is why, you know, I always thought the reason I like comics is because comics are a dynamic field, and I always just thought you can't get any, there's no medium out there where you can get as dynamic as you can with comics, which is why I always focused on superhero stuff. I'm not into any of the I could never draw an issue of The Walking Dead, because that would just bore me to tears, even if it's a great comic, you know.
And none of the romance comics for you either.
Oh, no. No. Yeah, that's the other thing. That's the thing is, my thing is, it's got to be superhero comics. I get offered a lot by, you know, with Image the way they are right now, I get a ton of offers all the time by people who want to do new books for Image. And they get signed on to Image, they just got to find a penciler. And I've gotten offered so many projects where they'll say, like, oh, your artwork would fit this book and perfectly. And I look at it and I go, it's about a girl roaming around her neighborhood in search of the meaning of life. I've been drawing superhero comics my whole. Where do you put the two together? Where Angel Medina would be perfect for this book. I don't see the connection there.
And I wanted to talk a little about that. You're not on a regular book and haven't been for a while.
Yeah.
So walk me through what it's like, your career now. I see you, you know, at our convention, and your, of course, your setup is amazing. and you've always got people coming up either looking for sketches or looking for original pages. But what's it like putting together a career when you don't have that book coming out every month?
Yeah, it is weird. It is weird because I always remember when my contract went out with Marvel, they wanted me to resign for them. You know, they had to ask me. I was a show up in Toronto, and this was Sunday, the last day of the convention. A couple of the Marvel guys came up to my table and they said, "Hey, yeah, you know, your contract's up in 2 weeks, and we'd really like for you to, resign for us." And I said, "Okay, well, you know, you never say yes right away because, you know, you have to do the whole contract BS, you know, where you talk about, you know, okay, this is what I want, blah, blah, blah." So I said, "Okay, well, you know, give me a couple of, you know," I told them if they could give me a couple of months instead of a couple of weeks, because I told them I wanted to take a break from doing comics, you know. And so they said, okay. And in my mind, I thought, well, I guess I will resign for them, you know. But then this was a Sunday. That following Monday, I was outside the hotel waiting for a cab to take me to the airport. And one of the guys working the convention, he was on his cell phone walking back and forth in front of me. And then he gets off his cell phone and he looks at me. He goes, "Well, they did it, Angel. I can't believe that they did it." And I go, "Who did what?" He goes, "Disney just bought Marvel." And when he said that to me, my experience for the last couple of years with Marvel had been, I'd been dealing a lot with a lot of the corporate crap and stuff, where the whole thing with Bendis came in and stuff like that, and where I quit a couple of times. And when I heard that Disney now was going to own Marvel, I just thought all that corporate crap that I've been putting up with these past couple of years, they're about to go up 100-fold now because of Disney. And then that made my decision. I said, "You know what? I'm not re-signing with these guys." And I didn't know what I was going to do, but all I knew is that I wasn't going to re-sign with Marvel, you know. So I actually took a couple of months off. And then I remember sitting down at my table thinking, like, well, I guess I should start, you know, trying to put something together. So I said, well, let me go talk to DC, because DC had been trying to be luring me away from Marvel. So as I started drawing, I drew these two pages of Justice League. And after I drew these two pages, I looked at what I drew and I thought, there's no way in hell DC is going to let me draw the Justice League like this, because the costumes look very different now. And I said, I don't want to draw for DC either. And then that was the weird thing, is when I finally came to the decision that I don't want to draw for Marvel or DC right now, that was such a weird thing. And I remember thinking, this was like, you know, years ago when, you know, DC, you know, from the Disney bomber, and I remember thinking in my head, I did not know what I was going to do with my life from this point on. And so then that's when I started, you know, I said, well, let me go to some conventions, and I finally started doing things I've never done before. Like, for instance, I never did private commissions, and people have been bothering me for years to do private commissions. So I started, okay, let me do some private commissions. I rarely did artwork at the conventions. I used to go to, those first shows I did for the Minnesota people, if you looked at my table, I rarely sold anything. I was just there to nerd out, to be honest with you. So I finally started selling things at conventions, doing artwork, and doing private commissions. Little did I know that, you know, you can get by pretty good on doing this stuff. So
that's one thing that I've noticed over the years. You've got a lot of people who kind of get out of that monthly book grind and start to do more and more commissions, and then they, I don't want to say they drop off the face of the earth.
Yeah.
But there is kind of a, for younger fans, it's like they don't know who they are anymore. But the older fans are just so, they're, now it's like, oh, now I can get art that I want specifically. And let's be honest, older fans have more money than a 24-year-old who's, you know, just out of college or, you know, working a job like that.
Let me tell you something. Older fans have more money than Marvel does, I tell you. But that's the one thing that surprised me about doing private commissions is, the downside to doing Marvel commissions is a big one, which you just brought up, is that you're not out there. You're not being out there. So people literally think you disappear, you know, you fell off the earth. And so that is a big downside. And that's something that that's why I still dabble. Like last year I did do, a couple of KISS books for IDW, and I just did a couple of covers that I'm going to do for Manowar. So I do a couple of those just to remind people that I'm still around. But the one thing that really surprised me is how much you make more money doing private commissions than you ever did, like, working for Marvel or DC, you know. When I think of the money that these guys pay me to do private commissions, I just think, man, Marvel and DC wouldn't pay me even half of that, you know, at this point. So.
Now, one of the things that you and I talked about this year, other than our love for the Bronze Age stuff, which I look forward to that conversation every year, and I know that there were a couple people around us who were just kind of rolling their eyes. It's like, oh, God, here they go again.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But you talked about how you now want to own your stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You want to work on your own characters.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And what set you to that mindset where it's, you know, working on Spider-Man and Thor and Venom and all these characters you grew up loving, now you want to do your own stuff. Walk me through how you get to that.
Well, to be honest, when I was working for the last couple of years I worked for Marvel, it was getting harder and harder to, you know, stay focused on the work because I wasn't digging it that much. So I would put my own little sub-stories in it that would happen in the background that no one ever could notice. I would tell people, like, yeah, I actually had this idea of what if this character was doing this. And so if you look at some of these Spider-Man issues, you start noticing that there was this guy walking around in the back, you know, doing little things here and there. And I said, that's sort of like me imagining my own subplot that's going on that no one else can see. And that's how I kept myself entertained. And so once I stopped working for Marvel and DC and I started doing the private commissions, I thought, well, someday I'll go back to Marvel and DC. But as time went on, I started realizing how I dreaded that idea. So I was talking to my brother one time, and he had talked about that. He goes, yeah, when you were young, you used to come up with your own characters. Have you ever thought about any of that stuff? I said, yeah, maybe. You know, I started seeing some of my friends in this business going into self-publishing. Like, for instance, Gene Ha just introduced me, and that looks really good, too. So everyone around me is doing that. So I started toying around with the idea, but I came up with a very loose idea. And once I came up with that idea, it literally did become the whole snowball effect where suddenly, within 2 months, I had the whole idea fleshed out. And then I got my whole, a whole universe almost practically worked out now of what I want to do with this stuff. So that's how I got to that point, that now the idea of going back to work tomorrow or DC does not appeal to me because now when I sit down and I work, think about some of my own characters and what I want to do with them, and when I actually start putting the artwork down, I think to myself, this is what it felt like when I was a kid drawing comic books. This is how much fun it was, and this is what I want to do. I want to have as much fun as I want to, and I know that the only way I'm going to be able to do that is to start doing my own characters. And that's where when you talk about, you know, dropping off the, you know, the comic scene, I don't worry too much about that because I know that I will come back into the scene doing my own stuff. And, I'm smart enough to know what I have to do as far as promoting it and all that other stuff. So I don't worry about people forgetting about me because if you do forget about me, eventually I'll be back around reminding you by publicizing the heck out of the work that I will be.
Now, as you're doing this, the publishing landscape's very different now.
Yes, yes.
To my mind. I often tell people, if you would have told me 20 years ago that my favorite publisher would be Image because of all the interesting, innovative, creator-driven stuff, they would have looked at you and kind of shook their head and asked to have me medicated.
Well, they would have thought, like, well, I must have misheard Corey. He didn't say Image. He said anti-Image.
But then there's also, I know IDW is... they're trying to pull people in because they've got the Hollywood connections. And
yes.
Dark Horse, that's where Gene Ha ended up, because Dark Horse is really kind of in a fight to keep their market share. And then you have all these other smaller publishers like, Stegbauer and Steve Bryant are with Action Lab with their new book, Ghoul Scouts, because it's an all-ages book, and they feel that that fits right. Is it something where you're going to get this done, and then you're going to go to the publishers and say, I've got this, what are you going to offer me? Or is it more, you kind of got an idea in your head of what you want to do, and you're going to pick which publisher fits that best?
I'm going to probably go the first route. I'm going to, right now, I'm focusing on the creative aspect of it. And once I get in, I've stacked up enough artwork, I want to be able to go to the publishers with the artwork as my sort of my weapon to say, listen, I don't just got a few issues. I got a bunch of issues. Here's what I want to do. I'm set out to do. What can I do? You know, what can you offer me? Or I might even try to see if I can do this all on my own, because I do have some people, some friends who I've seen where they have, I have one particular friend who started out with Image, then he moved over to a publisher called Speakeasy, and then he moved over by, he said, well, you know what, I'm just going to do this myself. And the last 5 years remaining on his book, he did it all by himself. And I thought, well, if he can do it by himself and no one knew who he was, I figure I got somewhat of a name. If he can do it, I can probably do it myself too. So I'm going to look at what my options are, but I'll worry about that once I've got enough of the creative side of it done. I'm just concentrating on the creative side. After that, I'll go to shopping it around to publishers, if that's the way I think I should go. I asked Gene Ha, like, how do you do Kickstarter and all that other stuff. So I'm doing my research as this goes along. I'm paying attention a lot to what's going on the landscape as far as publishing and printing goes. And if I can publish this all on myself, you know, without it killing me, I'd like to go that route. But, I mean, I'll wait to see what it's like once I'm ready to take that step.
The online world is a odd little beast.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are some people who are known people who've gone to Kickstarter who have it's just kind of fizzled. And there are other people who they go to Kickstarter and because they know the online world, it's like, okay, I can't tell you how many emails I get from people. Hey, I got this Kickstarter starting in a month. Really like to have, you know, do an interview with you to publicize this. And I see them showing up on tons of other podcasts and everything. And you know, they're pushing it online, and their Twitter is every day, and they're on Facebook every day promoting it. And it's almost like the Kickstarter becomes a full-time job.
Exactly, exactly. That's, you know, that's the thing I learned from Gene. That's come I didn't go. People keep asking me if I'm going to go through Kickstarter. And my initial thought when I first saw Kickstarter, I thought, hey, this could be something, but I waited on that. And then I started asking people around, and especially when I talked to Gene about that, and when he was telling me some of the stuff, I remember thinking to myself, well, you know what, I kind of don't want to do that. I don't want to put that much, you know. I want to concentrate on being able to, you know, like one of the things he told me is, get ready, you're going to have to stuff a lot of envelopes. And then I just thought, well, you know what, if there's a way where I can go about this where I don't have to stuff the envelopes, then I'd like to do that. I am not at all a lazy person. I will do what I need to do, but I am at that point where anything that allows me the maximum amount of time that I can concentrate on the creative side of it and allow me to be able to put this out to people, that's what I'm going to go for. So that's come. I haven't made my decision yet, and I haven't made the decision whether I will go with Kickstarter, but let's say this doesn't happen until like a year from now. The landscape changes so much. It could change. Kickstarter can change so much within a year. So that's why I'm not being very specific exactly how I'm going to go about this right now. Let's put it this way. I'm taking care of the creative stuff right now. When it comes time to take care of the publishing stuff, that's when I'll think about it, because then that way I'll be able to take a better look. Okay, this is what's happening right now on the publishing scale, on the landscape, or as far as printing and all that other stuff. And then I'll be able to make my decision better which way to go. My main objective right now is to have as much artwork, as much of the story done as possible, so that if I do have to go to the publisher, I want them their mouths to water to look at it and say, oh my God, Angel doesn't have just one or two or three issues done. He's got almost a whole year's worth of issues done here. What can we give this guy? Does that make sense to you?
Oh, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah,
and you're right about the landscape changing so much and so quickly. And I was going to bring up, I haven't gone to your webpage in a while, and looking at it, I'm not going to say that tumbleweeds are blowing through it, but it's real clear that you've moved from having a webpage, which, you know, 10, 15 years ago, that was what you did. And now, you know, you're putting your sketches up, you're putting your art up, you're doing all this stuff on Facebook, because people go to Facebook, they don't go to web pages anymore.
Oh,
they go to social media, and not to web pages.
Actually, I left that web page 2 years ago. I'm surprised they still have my stuff. People keep telling me, I keep going to your web page, and I keep saying, I'm not with them anymore. I don't know why they don't take my name down on there. And that's exactly it, because I saw that. I saw it. When I first put up on Facebook, let's put it this way. When I first decided that I was going to try to maybe, I was just fooling around with it, with my own creator-owned stuff. I put a couple of teasers up on Facebook. You know, there's one particular character I wanted, like this Hulk type character, and so I came up with it. I didn't want him to be like the Hulk. So I said, "Yeah, I need to come up with some different twist." I go, "Let me see how what people would think if I came up with this idea." Now, I had just come up with this idea. I just literally sketched it, and I said, "Maybe this will work." And then I scanned it, put it on Facebook, and I said, hey, guys, this is an idea I'm fooling around with. I was wondering maybe if I made this character like Hulk, but changed it in this way where his powers would be, would affect his personality this way instead. And oh, my God, Corey, the response I got from just putting this little sketch, I literally had messages from comic book stores wanting to put an order in based off just this one sketch. And I remember having to tell these guys, whoa, this is more like a feeler. I'm not, you know. And then that's the first time I realized, okay, you know what, this Facebook thing could probably work, you know, pretty good. And who knows, Facebook might be gone and passe in a year or so, but there will be something there to replace that. And that's the thing you got to pay attention to is, you know, what's going on at that moment. And that's why I'm not worried about that right now. That is the least thing I'm worried about right now. Because, Corey, me and you, we grew up at an era where the opportunities for self-publishers that exist now were nowhere near close to existing at the time when we first started, you know, when we were teenagers going to conventions and, you know, trying to get our stuff out there.
Well, and I look at the whole podcast universe, too. 10 years ago, when I first started listening to it, you know, you had to buy expensive equipment,
yes,
and you had to do this, and by the time Joe and I started, and that was 6.5 years ago, it was, oh, okay, I'm just using my beat-up old computer, we have two gaming headsets, let's go.
Yeah.
And now, the instant feedback is amazing. I put up a teaser last night for a new podcast that's starting up in about 3-4 months. It's going to be on the Solitaire Rose Network, but I have nothing to do with it.
Oh.
And I'm already getting emails. It's like, well, tell me what it is. What's this all about? And it's, look, this is the beginning of the ad campaign. I know that everything's instant on the internet, but I'm going to tease it for a while till everything comes out.
Yeah.
And, you know, with you, same thing. Here's this character I created. It's instant. It's I want it now.
Yeah. And
whereas before, Marvel would say, hey, you know, we got this character coming out, and then they would have to do this and this. And by the time, you know, from the time Roy Thomas and John Romita said, okay, we're going to do this book, it's a year and a half later before it's on the stands.
Oh, yeah, I know. And that doesn't exist anymore. Now, you know, it's funny because it excites me, but it is kind of scary because, like, after I put that stuff on with that character, I had to make the decision, you know what? Don't put anything up until you're ready to get this thing going here, because I want to be able to capitalize on that. But in order to capitalize it, I want to have the work done. Let's put it this way. Rob Liefeld would never have been able to get away with what he did during the 90s when he started putting out all that stuff if he had tried doing that now. Because now, as soon as you print something out, they want it now. And you have to show it now. And that can either be a blessing or that can be, you know, a curse. I think it's a curse for people who are still stuck in the old school way. But I think as time goes on and people catch on to it, there are going to be people who are going to start using this in a very effective way. I'm excited by it myself because I just think to myself, this is what, when you really think about it, when we were young and we first started getting into this business, if they would have told us we had this kind of accessibility to this kind of promotion and distribution, I never would have even bothered with Marvel and DC. I would have just started doing my own stuff right away.
And more everybody is doing that.
But here's the thing, too, though, and this is a good point because one of the I don't watch that much TV, but one of the few things I do watch is Silicon Valley. And one of the things that I think that the reason I like that is because that shows one of the biggest problems we as creatives have had for probably since time eternal is the ability to create these ideas and get them out to your fan base, but there's always been the business side of it that was like a wall in between that. And so suddenly here you are and you're a creator, and whatever it is that you're creating, you just want to put it out to people who want that stuff. And yet for many, many years, we've always had to like, okay, now I have to dance around the publisher and the distributor, you know, and stuff. And then it's all these things that don't really have to deal so much about you getting your work out there, more along the lines of what they have to deal with. Like what you're talking about your friend. Here he has all he wants to put this stuff out to people to read. But when he talks to these publishers, the reason they're not putting it out has to do with reasons that pertain to them and the publishing field, as opposed to, well, what does this guy have to do just to be able to put it out to, you know, to get it to the fans? And that's what I like about what's going on right now, is that that's becoming more and more minimized. And that's what I want. I know I'm going to have to deal with that stuff, but the less that I have to deal with it, the better. And that's the way I see it right now. I was recently talking to Frank Cho at the C2E2 show, and he was talking to me about that, about his frustrations with working with Marvel. And he was telling me, man, Angel, I just, you know, I got to resign with Marvel. And in my head, I thought, you're Frank Cho. You don't have to sign with Marvel, you know, but I didn't want to get into this with him because I know he's still sort of stuck in the old school way of, well, that's what you do. You get work with Marvel, they put your name out there, and if you want to pay your bills, this is the way you have to do it. And I'm sort of the other way of thinking, like, nah, you know, I think there is a way where we can find where you can do it your own way and not have to deal with all the big corporate stuff that comes from Marvel. If you're willing to put up with it, fine, but I'm just not one of those people right now.
Well, Angel, if people want to order a commission from you, what's the easiest way to do it?
Through Facebook right now.
So that's Angel Medina on Facebook. You have a webpage that you're not involved with.
Yes.
And is that also where people can pick up any original art that you may have laying around?
Right, yes. So, if you want to contact me all through Facebook. I will warn you on one thing. One of the reasons why I'm not as enthusiastically promoting myself as most people who would be on your podcast, oh, you can find me here and here and here, is because I've got to warn you, if anyone looking to get a commission from me right now, there is a 5-month waiting period on that. So usually I wait till like it's a 3-month waiting period, and then I'll start like, okay, if you want anything there, you know, if you want any kind of, you know, artwork from me, just look me up there. But when it gets to this point where like 5 or 6 month wait, I warn people ahead of time. I will put you on my list if you're willing to wait, you know, 5 or 6 months for your piece.
And Angel shows up at tons of conventions. He publicizes them on the Facebook as well. I want to thank you for coming on the show. It's always fun to chat with you. It's one of the things I look forward to every year.
Yeah, and it seems like we don't get to do enough of it, to be honest with you. So.
I don't think we ever will.
And that is Angel Medina. As I said, Angel has said he wants to come on a regular episode of Crazy Comics and Stories, so that'll be coming this summer. There is a lot coming up this summer. I've got another interview next week with Dangerous Dan Moore, who's been on Crazy Comics and Stories a lot, draws Everyday Gods. He draws the web strip that I write. And we kind of talk about how he got into doing webcomics. It's a very different path from a lot of the other people I've talked to about webcomics and comic books and stuff. Got other artists coming up. I've got other ideas coming up. If you are not a fan of the Facebook page, head on over to the Facebook page. Become a fan. Facebook.com/SolitaireRoseRadio. I've got an idea I'm doing in a couple of weeks where I'm going to do an improv show where I'm just going to put up hey, give me topics, and I'm going to read the topic, talk about it with the microphone on, do that for an hour, and drop that episode up as soon as it's done with no editing. So that'll be a lot of fun. I've got the EC history coming up. I've got more interviews coming up. It's going to be a busy summer. There's a lot of podcasts coming. We got a lot of stuff coming. We got another convention we're doing. A new addition to the Solitaire Rose Radio Network that I'm not on is coming. Head on over to scrabbling.solitairerose.com and you might see some hints. Along with all this stuff, we have ads, and here they are. Believe it or not, kids, this silliness has actual real sponsors. Our first sponsor is Graze.com. Graze gives you healthy snacks sent to your house. You can have them delivered weekly, bi-weekly, monthly, and your first box is free if you use the code CORYS3R5B. Our second sponsor is Bombas. Bombas socks are some of the best socks in the world, and remember, for every pair you buy, they donate a pair to a homeless shelter or other worthy cause. Just go to bombas.gotocloud.org/SF30. That's right, those are our ads. Go check out our sponsors. I want to thank you for listening. Please spread the word. When a new episode comes out, retweet it, repost it on Facebook, tell your friends, wake the kids, phone the neighbors. Get the news out there. The more listeners we have, the better. The more we spread the word, the better. And I want to thank each and every one of you who listens, who subscribes, who sends me feedback. You are the reason I keep doing this. And I'll be back very soon with more stories. Ow! Another fine podcast from Solitaire Rose Networks.
The end.